Lecture 10, The End of the Old Kingdom.
Hi, welcome back. Let me recap a little bit where we left off last time. You remember in the Third Dynasty we saw the first pyramid ever being built, the Step Pyramid of Zoser. Then in the Fourth Dynasty, we start to get the true pyramids. We get my man Sneferu building three pyramids, including the first true pyramid ever. And then we ended with Khufu, or Cheops, either way, same guy, building the Great Pyramid of Giza. Well, in this lecture, I'm going to try to show you where it all goes. And it's mostly downhill, I'm afraid. At the end of the Fourth Dynasty, the Dynasty of Sneferu, the Dynasty of Khufu, we start to get some changes, and we're not sure exactly why. The successor of Khufu, Djedefre, doesn't build a pyramid at Giza. For some reason, he moves away to a place called Abu Roash, several miles away. And he starts to build a strange kind of pyramid, building a big trench in the ground and never finishes it. We don't really know what it would have been. But after Djedefre, his successor, comes back to Giza, and we start to get a sense that tradition is being restored. Now, the successor is Khafre. The Greeks called him Khafre, but the Egyptian name was really Khafre. It's the same person. Now, Khafre builds a pyramid that is just about the same size as the Great Pyramid, only 20 feet smaller. You wonder why he built it a little bit smaller rather than a little bit bigger? Well, the answer is probably out of deference to his father. But it's a big pyramid. Now, he has an innovation, though, but it's accidental. Didn't plan it. It's the Sphinx. If you'll remember, when you built a pyramid in the Fourth Dynasty, you didn't just build a pyramid. You had a complex. You had a mortuary temple next to it. There was a valley temple where perhaps you were mummified, and a causeway connecting the valley temple to the pyramid. So once you were mummified in the valley temple, your body would be brought in a sacred procession down this causeway and placed in the pyramid. Well, if you trace the causeway from the pyramid of Khafre straight down to the valley temple, it's not a straight line. What happened was they were excavating the causeway, digging through the sandstone, and they hit a huge rock. A sandstone rock. Rather than remove it, they carved the Sphinx out of it. Now, the Sphinx is the head of a man. We're pretty sure it's Khafre. And the body of a lion. The idea is it symbolizes the intelligence of the man and the power of the lion. The lion is going to be a kind of pharaonic talisman, a totem animal. When Ramses the Great went into battle, he had a pet lion with him. It's pretty scary if you're going up against Ramses, he's got a lion next to him. So the Sphinx is really an accident. It wasn't planned. Now, let me say a few things about the Sphinx. There's an awful lot of rumors about how old the Sphinx is. You've probably heard the controversy. Many people have started to say that the Sphinx is much older than believed. Now, the Sphinx was constructed about 4,500 years ago, roughly, because it's Khafre who built it. We're virtually sure. But a couple of geologists have suggested, when they looked at the rock, that it looks like water erosion on the Sphinx. Now, if it's water erosion, there wasn't water there in 2500 BC or so. It's probably, they say, rain, that Egypt was much more moist at this point, and they pushed the date of the pyramid back to 10,000 BC. They're wrong. Let me just say it. They're wrong. Almost all Egyptologists agree the Sphinx was carved during the reign of Khafre. Now, one of the reasons we're quite sure that they're wrong is there was no significant Egyptian civilization in 10,000 BC that could have carved the Sphinx. Remember from our prehistoric lecture, they were just starting to learn about farming even. So there's no doubt about it. The Sphinx is not from 10,000 BC. It's more recent. It's still pretty impressive. There are a couple of other myths about the Sphinx. One is that Napoleon, when he brought his expedition to Egypt in 1798, shot off the nose, that they were using the Sphinx for target practice. Now, there are two reasons why I can tell you that's false. One is, Napoleon was really reverential towards ancient monuments. He had brought 150 scientists to study the monuments of Egypt. He wasn't about to blow them away. But the better, more convincing argument that Napoleon didn't shoot off the nose of the Sphinx is that we have drawings of the Sphinx done in the 18th century, earlier than when Napoleon was there, and the nose is missing then. The Sphinx nose was missing probably for 1,000 years. It's wind erosion that caused the nose to be gone. Other myths about the Sphinx, you know, all of Freudian psychology, not all of, but a lot of Freudian psychology is based on the idea that the Sphinx is a woman because of the hair. See, it looks like a woman's hair, but it's not a woman's hair. It's a cloth headdress that's called a Nemes headdress that only the pharaoh wore. It's a kind of pleated thing. You see it on the gold mask of Tutankhamun, these striations going around. That's what the Sphinx is wearing. The Sphinx is not a woman. You know what's sort of funny about this headdress that the Sphinx wears? If you look at the really bad movies about Egypt, the grade B movies, you'll see that usually they've got the slaves and the servants wearing this headdress. But it was only for pharaohs. It was only for royalty. There's another interesting thing about the Sphinx, and I can go on about the Sphinx forever. I love the Sphinx. The beard of the Sphinx, it's missing. Originally, the Sphinx had a beard. Pharaohs wore false beards. Pharaohs were usually clean-shaven. Almost all Egyptians were clean-shaven. But it was a sign of authority to have a beard. So they wore a little, it was probably plaited, made out of maybe straw or maybe even human hair, had strings, and a chin strap. So you, for official occasion, the pharaoh would tie on his beard, and it would tie in the back. If you look at the Sphinx, you will see that on the sides are indentations which are indicating the chin strap. So we know that the Sphinx had a beard. And now I'll tell you something that I'm sure you didn't know. I'll tell you where the beard is. It's in two places. One place surprised me. I didn't know it was there. Inside the Egyptian Museum in Cairo is a library called the Maktaba. It's Arabic for library. And the librarian for many years was a wonderful old woman, Dr. Diablo Ghazi. I went to visit her one day, and I almost fell on my head. I tripped over something. And I asked her, I said, Dr. Dia, what did I trip over? She says, oh, that's the beard of the Sphinx. There is a piece of the beard of the Sphinx that they found when excavating. It's probably 3 feet, 4 feet long, and it's just a piece of it. And it's in the library, on the floor, in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. Now, there's another piece of the Sphinx's beard that exists in the British Museum. And that's a bit of a political problem. The Egyptian government would like to have the beard of the Sphinx back. Perhaps it can be restored. If you put the two pieces together, maybe you've got something, and then you peg it in, you can put in a rod. It can be restored. Such things can be done nowadays. And I think the British Museum would really like to give it back. But they can't. They're afraid. It's not on display, by the way, in the British Museum. It's simply in a basement storage area. But I think the problem is they don't want to start a precedent. If you give the beard of the Sphinx back to Egypt, the next thing they ask for is the Rosetta Stone. So they're a little bit afraid of asking, you know, giving it back and saying, sure, why not? We don't need it. So the beard of the Sphinx exists in two places. One is the British Museum. The other is in the library at the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. Now, when Khafre built his monument, he didn't expect to hit big rock, so they just carved the Sphinx out. The causeway bends because they had to go around the Sphinx, so it's not a straight line, but it leads to the Valley Temple. And this is where perhaps Khafre was mummified. The Valley Temple is a unique monument. It is the only large Egyptian temple we have from this period. And it shows us how they built them, out of huge stones. They're monoliths. They are large stones weighing maybe 20, 30 tons. Right? And it's the only thing we have of that kind. It has an alabaster floor. So it gives you an idea of the wealth they had to pave an entire temple with alabaster. And quite a few important statues were also found there. But that's Khafre. He was trying to continue the tradition. He was building a pyramid like the Great Pyramid. He was building a mortuary temple, a valley temple. He was keeping the tradition. But after him, things change. Now, his successor is called Mycerinus by the Greeks, Menkaure in Egyptian. Mycerinus also built on the Giza Plateau. So you've got three fairly large pyramids on the Giza Plateau. You've got the Great Pyramid of Giza, which is Cheops, Khufu. You've got Khafre's. And now you have Mycerinus's, but it's smaller. It's about a fifth the size of the Great Pyramid. Why? It may be that the economy was changing. It may be that they were running out of money, and didn't have the money to do it. But it's a little different kind of pyramid. It's small, as I say. But he tried to do something special, perhaps because it was small and he had to compensate. It's paved not with limestone. The outer casing isn't limestone. It's granite, pink Aswan granite, harder than limestone, more expensive, more lavish, but it's unfinished. If you look at the casing, you can see it's rounded on the ends. It would have been carved flat, flush with the pyramid, but it was never finished. And that's the last of the pyramid building at the Giza Plateau. Now, what happens next? Something very strange. Mycerinus's successor is a pharaoh, the last pharaoh of this dynasty, the last pharaoh of the fourth dynasty, the last of the family of Sneferu and Khufu, the great pyramid builders, this family that grew up building pyramids. The last pharaoh is Shepsefkaf. He moves away from Giza. Why, we don't know. There's still room on the Giza Plateau. You know, there are a couple of other smaller pyramids on the Giza Plateau also. They're for queens. They're smaller, but there's room for other pyramids. But Shepsefkaf says no. He moves back to Saqqara, back to where the step pyramid was built, where the pyramid building all started. And he doesn't build a pyramid. He builds a mastaba. Going back, curious, breaking with tradition. It's called the Mastaba al-Farun in Arabic. It means the Mastaba of the Pharaoh. And it's in the shape of a cartouche. Remarkable. But that's the end of the Fourth Dynasty. The great pyramid building era is ended. We're never going to see another pyramid like these of Sneferu, Khufu, Kefren. Never again. And in a sense, Egypt will never return to this greatness. The next dynasty, it's an interesting one, the Fifth Dynasty. There are big changes now, and we're not sure exactly why. Let me tell you about a papyrus. Remember I mentioned last time about the magical papyrus called Papyrus Weskar, which told about Sneferu and how a maiden had lost an amulet. And it was, well, this papyrus has lots of stories in it. It's in the Berlin Museum, and it tells the story of the beginning of Dynasty 5. The papyrus is set during the time of Khufu, builder of the Great Pyramid. And Khufu is having his sons, and there are plenty of them, tell him stories to amuse him. And each tells a story. And when one son comes up, it's his turn, and he says, rather than telling a story, let me bring a magician, and he'll tell you the future. So the magician is brought in, and he starts to tell the future. And what he sees is the beginning of the Fifth Dynasty. He says, how the new dynasty is going to start. And he says it's going to start with the birth of triplets. Right? Triplets. And these are going to be the first kings of the Fifth Dynasty. So we have this magical story about how the Fifth Dynasty begins. Now, we know that it begins with changes. The kings of the Fifth Dynasty, we can call them solar kings, sun kings. They seem to be really more into sun worship than anybody else. They innovate something that's never been seen in Egypt before, a solar temple, a temple dedicated to the sun. They have pyramids also. They're small affairs. But they go to different sites. They go to Abu Ghurab and Abu Sir. These are about a mile apart from each other, not too far from Saqqara, not too far. And they build these sun temples. They're large altar. And in front of the altar is a stone, a large, it's not quite an obelisk, but it's called a Benben stone. We don't really know the function. It was some kind of stone that was worshipped in some way. But they have these sun temples and small pyramids. These pharaohs also have unusual names. The first one is Userkaf. That's not a strange name. But after him, the pharaohs take Re names, meaning they incorporate Re, the sun god, into their names. So we get people like Sahu Re, Nefer-Ir Ka Re. All of these are praising the sun god Re. So they're building solar temples. They have names that incorporate Re. Something is going on. I'm not sure exactly what. It could be that the priests are becoming sort of influential and saying, you know, the right god is really Re. He's the big god. So they're starting to change things, perhaps for religious reasons. But at the end of the Fifth Dynasty, we get an even bigger change. The last king of the fifth dynasty starts a tradition that will be continued a little while, but it's absolutely unique. The pharaoh Unas builds a pyramid at Saqqara. It's a small pyramid. It's modest. But inside, it's incredible. He has texts carved inside, all over the burial chamber, on the walls leading to the burial chamber, which we call the pyramid texts. Now remember, up until this time, one of the puzzles is, why don't they put names on the pyramids even? Why are the burial chambers of, say, the Meidum Pyramid, the Red Pyramid, the Bent Pyramid, the Great Pyramids at Giza, why are they all blank walls, uninscribed? Nobody knows. But Unas changes this. On the walls, covering the walls, are thousands of hieroglyphs, and they're all magical. They're called the pyramid texts, and what they're supposed to do is make sure that the pharaoh makes it to the next world. Now, people often say, it's amazing that you can build the Great Pyramid of Cheops in 22 years, roughly the time it took to build it. I think it's amazing that Unas could build his pyramid, because it took an incredible amount of work and labor, artists carving these hieroglyphs, and they go from ceiling to floor in columns. Each column is a separate spell. Hundreds of beautifully carved, painted hieroglyphs. And you know, I've looked at the hieroglyphs very carefully. I figured that the way to do it quickly, efficiently, is to have stencils. Like when you were a kid and you wanted to do the ABCs nicely on your report, you could have a stencil and you could do it. I figured they'd have hieroglyph stencils. So I looked very carefully at the owls, just those, that one hieroglyph, which is the hieroglyph M, the sound M is an owl. They were all individually done. They weren't stenciled on. You can tell. They're not the same. They're not all exactly the same height. The feathers don't go all the same way. These were each an individual little sculpture. A remarkable thing. It would have taken years and years to do it. I often wonder, did they do it on the wall? Or did they do it outside and bring the blocks in? You know, you could have more men working. We're not sure, but it's a remarkable achievement. But let me tell you what they say. Now, the pyramid texts are intended to protect the body of the pharaoh in three different stages. Now remember, the king is buried inside the pyramid, inside a sarcophagus. And the sarcophagus of Unas, by the way, is still there, and it's a thing of beauty. It's painted like the palace facade. Remember the serech, that rectangle that represents a palace? It has paintings on it just like that, beautifully colored, because there's no weathering inside the pyramid, so they still have the vibrant colors. But the first stage that the pyramid text is supposed to take care of is protect the body of the pharaoh as it lies in the burial chamber. So you get magical spells like, Unas lies in his burial chamber. Nothing disturbs his rest. Unas is not bitten by a scorpion. No robber disturbs the rest of Unas. So the first spells are all to make sure that the body of the king will stay undisturbed in its sarcophagus until it's ready for the big journey. The next stage is when the pharaoh is going to go across the sky to the west. Now, the west was always associated with the dead. Probably the reason is that the sun dies in the west every day and is reborn in the east. So, for example, during most of Egyptian civilization, the Egyptians buried their dead on the west. They lived on the east bank, but buried on the west. Almost all tombs are on the west bank. Pyramids are on the west. Almost always, the west is the land of the dead. Even Osiris, the god of the dead, is called Lord of the West. And you know what the Egyptians called people who died? I mean, we have euphemisms today. I mean, we don't say, oh, he's dead. You know, if you go to a funeral, he might be the dearly departed. It sounds like he just went on a trip. The Egyptians called them Westerners. Dead people were called Westerners. And when somebody died, they said, he went west. Right? So the west was always associated with the dead. So when you were going to make your journey to the next world, you were going to go through the sky to the west in a boat, a solar boat. Now, the next set of spells are intended to make sure that when Unas makes the big journey, he's not going to be impeded in any way. The boat is going to have smooth sailing through the sky. So you have spells like The bark of Unas progresses swiftly. No enemy of Unas hinders the bark. You get things like that. So the second stage of the pyramid texts is to make sure that you're going to go west safely. The third and last stage of pyramid texts is that Unas is going to be accepted into the next world. He's made the journey. His body has been protected inside the sarcophagus in the burial chamber. Stayed there till time of resurrection. Makes the big journey. Now we've got to make sure that he's accepted in the next world. So you have magical spells like Unas is greeted by Osiris. Unas is welcomed by Horus. Isis is on his left. Horus is on his right. They greet the pharaoh. So we're told that Unas makes it. It's a magical principle. The word is the deed. If you say it, it will happen. There's a couple of spells that are kind of curious. First, about getting accepted into the next world. It's almost like they had backup systems. He's getting to the next world. How's he going to get in? Unas ascends his ladder. Right? And the gods are holding the ladder to steady it. So one way to get into the next world is by the ladder. Now, if that doesn't work, Unas ascends the steps to the next world. Some people think that the steps may be the steps of a step pyramid. That may be what they intended to do. But Unas has plenty of ways to get into the next world, and that's the purpose of the pyramid text. There's one text that there's been a lot of literature about, very strange text. It's called the Cannibal Hymn. It's on the walls of the pyramid, and we're pretty sure we know what it means. It describes Unas as eating the entrails of his enemy. And Unas eats parts of the gods even. Now, the notion, of course, is that you've really defeated your enemy, and maybe even if you eat his entrails or eat part of the gods, you gain their power. That's the notion. But the question is, are we supposed to take this literally? Do we really want to think that Unas was a cannibal or that the Egyptians were cannibals? Well, most of us don't take it literally. We think the idea is, you know, it's like, I'm going to knock your head off. You don't mean it literally. But one Egyptologist did, and it led to a curious theory. E.A. Wallace Budge. He was the curator of the British Museum's Egyptian collection. In those days, in the 1920s, it was called the Keeper of Egyptian Antiquities. Budge wrote a book on Osiris. And if you'll remember the myth, Budge has an explanation for this myth. Osiris, if you remember, is the first one to resurrect. He's hacked to pieces, he's put back together, and he resurrects. So the Egyptian religion is one of resurrection. Budge claims that this myth was introduced to stop the Egyptians from being cannibals. See, if you told them, no, don't eat that relative, he needs his body for the next world, then it would stop cannibalism. So Budge at least is one who took this myth literally as true. Most of us think he's wrong, that it wasn't literally true. There's virtually no evidence for cannibalism in Egyptian society. There are no bones, for example, with human tooth marks on it, which is how you would tell. There are no texts that say anything like that. So almost certainly, it's merely metaphorically, and Unas is going to make it to the next world. Unas is the last king of Dynasty 5. The kings of Dynasty 6 are going to build pyramids at Saqqara, but they're small things, really inconsequential. If you look at them today, they look very much like hills, sort of, they look almost like natural hills. You can't really tell they were once beautiful pyramids. Now, the pharaoh Teti in Dynasty 6 built a pyramid. As I say, a small affair, nothing impressive. But at the same time that he was building his little pyramid, which included pyramid texts, his chancellor, Mereruka, is building his mastaba. Now remember, the mastabas are the above-ground, bench-like structures. But Mereruka's mastaba is so big that it rivals the pyramid of the pharaoh. What I think we're getting is the pharaoh's power is being diminished, and the nobles around him are increasing in wealth. Don't know why, but if you look at Mereruka's mastaba, it has 32 rooms. I mean, it's practically an apartment house. And all the rooms are carved with beautiful scenes of what Mereruka wanted to do in the next world. It shows him harpooning a hippo. He was a hunter. It shows fishing scenes. It shows him with his family banqueting. It's 32 rooms of beauty. It must have taken an incredible amount of manpower to do something like that. And inside Mereruka's little chamber where he has a statue is a beautiful statue. Beautiful. It rivals royal art. It shows Mararuka, and he's standing in a kilt. Now, let me tell you about this kilt. This kilt was a sign. It's a starched kilt. It was worn by officials. And what that means is, I'm an official. I've got this starched kilt. I couldn't possibly do manual labor. It's like the Mandarin fingernails, which were a sign that the Mandarins didn't have to do any work. This was a way of saying, I'm an official. I don't have to do anything. So Mararuka built this incredible mastaba. While the Pyramid of the Pharaoh isn't really anything special, I think we're really getting almost a competition between the Pharaoh and his nobility. Now, let me say a couple of things about the last Pharaoh of Dynasty VI. This is going to be the end of the Old Kingdom. Now, I use the words Old Kingdom. Egyptian history is so long, 3,200 years virtually of recorded history, of records that we have, that you have to break it up into manageable chunks or else it just becomes too much. And Egyptologists do that in a simple way. The beginning we call the Old Kingdom. At the end of the Old Kingdom, there was a total collapse. That's an intermediate period. First intermediate period. Then Egypt rises again, gets its act together. We call that the Middle Kingdom. Years of prosperity, stability, but then it collapses again. As far as I know, Egypt is the only civilization to have two really total collapses and get its act together again. The only one. And then, when it gets its act together again, we call it the New Kingdom. So we've got Old Kingdom, intermediate period, Middle Kingdom, intermediate period, New Kingdom, and then there's going to be late period and decline. This is Egyptology talk. The Egyptians never talked that way. They never said, we're in the New Kingdom now. They never viewed it that way. But we view it that way. So what we're looking at right now in Dynasty VI is the end of the Old Kingdom. It's the end of the glory days. And the last pharaoh of Dynasty VI who ends the Old Kingdom is a pharaoh called Pepi II. He has a couple of distinctions that are kind of neat. Pepi II is the longest reigning monarch in the history of the world. He ruled for 94 years. 94 years. Of course, he was a child when he ascended to the throne, maybe only 4 years old, but that means he lived to be 98. Right? Longest reigning monarch in the history of the world. There's even a great story connecting with him when he was a kid. When he was a kid pharaoh, he's 8 years old, and he's got his chancellor to Nubia in the south. He sent him to Nubia to bring back gold and ivory and all these great things, of course, or at least somebody sent him. He's only 8 years old. The chancellor writes back and says, you know, I'm also bringing you a pygmy. Right? Bring him a pygmy. And Pepi gets so excited. Right? He writes back to his vizier. He says, I want this pygmy more than the gold. He says, put strong men on either side of him if he goes to the river so he doesn't fall in and drown. Have strong men sleeping next to him in his tent. But I want this pygmy. I will reward you more than anyone. And the pygmy makes it back. And you know this letter that Pepi II as a kid wrote to his chancellor in Nubia? The chancellor on his tomb put it on the wall, had it carved on the wall, showing that the pharaoh cared enough to write a personal letter. It was a big deal. Right? So we've got a little bit of documentation on Pepi II as a kid. But he lives very long, maybe too long. Remember, the pharaoh was the physical leader of Egypt. He had to take the men out in the army. He had to do battle. He had to lead. Pepi lives to be perhaps 98. That may be the reason why the Old Kingdom collapsed. Pepi may have just lived too long. He could no longer lead the army. He was feeble. What could you do? He's a god king. He stays put. This may be the reason why the Old Kingdom eventually collapsed with Pepi II. That's the danger of having a pharaoh-centric government, all the power in the hands of one person. If he's great, he can do great things. But if he's not great, you can be in trouble. It may have led to the first intermediate period, the total collapse of Egyptian civilization. And we'll talk about that next time. See you then.